Good evening. My name is Harry, and I'm an alcoholic. Very, very nervous. The last time I told a complete story was about 10 years ago. So I'll have to say to you what I always say to people who I know are going to do this, and they say, yeah, I'm so nervous. I said, don't be nervous. They're not listening anyway, you know. There must be about 50 meetings going here at the same time, if you guys are anything like me. Anyway, I want to thank Joe for asking me to lead this meeting. He asked me a few weeks ago, and without thinking, I said yes. I was always taught in AA not to say no. And my sponsor once told me that this is a good way to break, thank you, some isolation in the program. Anyway, let me do the statistics first. I've got two birthdays coming up. Next week is my natal birthday, and I don't want to talk about that one. And in 4 weeks is my AA birthday. Well, might as well. I'll be 88 next week, and I'll be 38 years sober in May 25th. And I'll tell you right up front, I got the statistics behind me. It was probably the smartest thing that I ever did in my life, although I didn't think so at the time. Now I got that behind me. Now I can start. I was born and brought up in New York City. And in fact, as a little side note, where I was born, there are multi-million-dollar condos. Not when I was born there. I was born to a middle-class, low-middle-class working family. And I always like to say that if World War II didn't come along, I probably had a very good chance of being a juvenile delinquent, we used to call them, or a lot of them you see here in the program, you know, new people and stuff. But when the war came, when the war came, everything changed, and I don't get a chance to speak about some of those experiences, and it really was an important part of my life looking back, because the regular meetings that I go to, they get tired of hearing the war stories and stuff, but here I got fresh meat here. And I've got to fill in 45 minutes. I have to share with you, I got sober in New York, if you can't tell by the accent, but we've been out here now 26 years. And they say in New York that anything over 20 minutes is an ego trip. And so here I have to speak for 45 minutes, so I'm going to start during the Depression. I was born in 1925. God, is that a long time ago? And things were pretty good, as my parents told me. I remember very, very little. The only memory I have of my real very early years was when Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic, and I remember the song which I sang, and I was 2 years old at the time. And for some reason, I remember that. I can't remember what I had for breakfast this morning, let alone that. But my friend John O'Connor, I can break his anonymity now. John O'Connor was a New York City cop. He was the first one who, the first policeman who broke his anonymity and went to a meeting. After that, they started to have meetings for the police, separate ones. They've got more now than regular people do, you know. But at that time, they were highly, highly, you know, secretive, and they didn't want to be known as alcoholics. But he was a great guy. I actually liked him better than my sponsor. I didn't much care for my sponsor, but he was. And I think now, after so many years, I think that I was too similar to my sponsor, and I was quite different than John. I'm an old-time salesman, so if I digress and jump around, and like I told you, I'm not a circuit speaker by a long shot. And my sponsor, Judd, died. He's remained my only sponsor for 36 years, and he died last year. But he died in Florida, and we both got sober in New York, and I was out here. But as the years went on, we became not like sponsor and sponsee, but like two good friends sharing, which happens a lot of times. And many times, and I happen to be fortunate enough to have several sponsees here tonight, I get more from them. They don't even know it, and I don't tell them, you know. then I get... Actually, it's a two-way street. It's my opinion. Everything I say here tonight is my own opinion. I got some strong ones sometimes, but I will tell you my credo in AA right up front, and which I learned from my sponsor, is that I try never to use the word you in AA, because in my experience, I never met an alcoholic who likes to be talked at, you know. You'll stay sober. You got to do the steps. You're not going to enough meetings. All I do is, like I learned from my sponsor, is I tell him, geez, I got to get to more meetings. I'm telling him to get his ass to more meetings, you know. And that's the way I pass it on. I always talk about how I stay sober, and I try and share my own experience. And just to take a shortcut, coming in at the age of 50 is was quite interesting when I came in. It was just when the drugs were coming in strong, but there was still the old-time Irishman would sit in the front row, and he says, "We're here to talk about booze, B-O-O-Z-E. My name is Joe Cochran, and you don't get this program by your genitals, you know." And that's what I was taught right from the get-go. And then came the cocaine, and the age of the ladies coming into the program started to drop. And you talk about dating in New York City, going to meetings, and I had a sponsor. And my sponsor said, 90 women in 90 days. My wife has heard this 100 times, and she hates it when I say that. But it's true. He says, if you stay sober, and this is before we met in the program. Anyway, I grew up on the streets of New York, and everything was calm and collected, and... I think I had a happy childhood, but it's a shame it lasted for 50 years, you know. I'm 16 years old. There are some memories that really stick in my mind. Like I say, I don't remember a lot of things. I was 16 years old, and I was in a big no-no place. I was in the pool room. Now, all the bums hung out in pool rooms, you know. But it was Sunday. We'd all like to play. That's what we did. And this was on the streets of New York. And the radio comes in, and then the announcement comes in with Pearl Harbor. So that Sunday, I was 16 years old. I was going to high school, and my entire life changed. Not only my life, but millions of other people. In school, everybody started to join the war effort. You know, that was 1941. So I was 16 then, and there was no chance. I didn't have to register or anything for the draft, and I was going to high school. Everybody, the whole attitude changed. All these street kids, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do that. Everything got pointed towards war effort, because, you know, if you remember or you read it, we weren't doing that great yet. I was 16. So the next 2 years, almost 2 years, I finished up in high school. And in fact, they say in your yearbook when you graduate from high school that my ambition was to go into the U.S. Army Air Corps. And I'll be damned if that didn't happen. And that's what happened. I graduated in January of 1943. I was still not 18. And then I turned 18 in April of 1943, and I got my greetings, my draft notice, 2 months later. And the month after that, I was drafted into the Army. And so I was just 18, and, my mother, I mean, what went on? I have to tell you one humorous thing. There's a place that we got inducted after you passed your physical in Manhattan, right at the main induction center. After you passed your physical, you come up there, and there's a board of military guys. And look, man, I'm 18, supposedly wise kid from the streets of New York, and they said Army, Navy, or Marines. So I thought of what I said to my mother, and I said, "How about the Coast Guard?" I was not very patriotic, you know. And because we were reading what a beating we were taking in some places. And they said, "Coast Guard's float, kid," you know. And so I says, okay, I'll go into the Army. Now, the Air Force, the Air Corps, was still part of the Army at that time. And so I went in, and about a month after I went in, I was assigned to the Army Air Corps. And I did pretty good in the, at the basic training, and I did good with the code, Morse code, and so they sent me to radio school. And there was a more humorous story than that. They asked, I did well in the mechanic school also, radio operator mechanic, and so they asked me, which one do you want to go to? We have openings in radio school, and this is in New York, never had left the city yet. And we have radio schools in Sioux Falls, South. No, I didn't say Sioux Falls. They said in Chicago, Illinois, and St. Louis. That sounded good to me because it was some fancy hotel in downtown Chicago. And I says, "And where are the mechanic school?" And they said, "Gulfport, Mississippi." I said, "Forget about being a mechanic, you know." So that's the way I became a radio man. And We get on the train, and here's a train full of New York guys that had never been out of the city. Our parents didn't have any money, so we wouldn't even go away in the summertime. We spent our summers in the city, and we're on this train, and the train does not even stop near St. Louis, and it doesn't stop in Chicago, and it keeps going north and north, and then we get into farmland, and there's cows outside, and these guys are running, "Yeah, there's a cow." There were guys, it was a true story. There were, most of us had never even seen a live cow. And here are the cows on either side of this train, and there's a trainload of guys going away to radio school, flight radio school. And it was most of them from New York. And I go into radio school, and then I get a letter from a cousin of mine. He says, "What are you training for?" And I says, "For an air crew." He says, "Well, why do you want to fly as an enlisted man? Why don't you fly as an officer?" I says, "Because they didn't let us go to college. I left that out when I graduated. I wanted to go on to college." And they said, "No, you had to register for the draft." So this was 1943, like I told you. We weren't losing, but we weren't winning. And so I go into this flight training school, and I was sent into a pressure chamber to simulate high altitudes, and my ears clogged up on me, and I thought my head was coming off, and I flunked that. The ironic part of it is I wound up doing the same thing as an enlisted man as I would have done as a pilot, exactly the same, except I became a radio operator gunner in the Army Air Corps. I went through radio school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Then I went to gunnery school in Yuma, Arizona. If there's anybody here from Yuma, Arizona, all I can say is, like Don Rickles says, "I'm sorry," you know. and we drove through there, and it's still the same way. They still have gunnery ranges there. The Marines still have a gunnery range. And I looked for my radio school, and I couldn't even find it until I found out a few years later from somebody in the program that they had paved over it and became part of the Yuma International Airport. I couldn't find anybody I went to gunnery school with. Anyway, I never get a chance to tell these stories. This is nice, you know. They'd laugh at me in my men's meeting if I started to tell all these stories again. Anyway, I finished the gunnery school, and they put me into the Air Transport Command. And this was, actually, we were flying overseas, At first, I was supposed to go to the 8th Air Force, and I lucked out on that one because we were having a difficult time. And I was assigned to a crew, and what we did was ferry supplies from California. I was stationed in California, in Long Beach at that time, over to Hawaii and then to Australia and then fly back. And what we became was like truckmen, this ferry command. And we would bring back wounded fellows, you know, who were fighting in the early fighting that had been out there since 1942. And I want you to know that I don't think I was 19 yet. I went through radio school, went through gunnery school, and I was assigned to a crew, and I did that for a while. And then we get our orders to go overseas. And instead of calling it a leave at that time, now I'm stationed in California, here in Long Beach, and I get my orders to go home, and they give you what is called a delay en route. It was a fancy word for a furlough. They give you, let's say, 10 days to go from where you are, grab as much time as you can at home, and get yourself in time to your next base, which I know is to go overseas. I said, wow, you know. Already my so-called alcoholic personality popped up, and I don't even want to say what I said on that one. So they're giving me 10 days to go from California. You can't get a plane ride. I tried to hitch a plane ride. And we went by train, and they had taken out all the old trains. Everything was the war effort. I mean, these trains were from the Civil War. Really, they were so old. It took me 5 days to get back to New York. And I think I was home for about 2 days. And it was time to go to my next base to get ready to go overseas. And I says, screw them. I says, I'm going to stay home for a couple more days. So I came back late for about 2 or 3 days, and I really didn't care because I knew I was going away. And they broke my rank. I went, reached the stratospheric rank of a sergeant. And, well, when you flew, you had to fly it as a certain rank. And I think I was still bitter about flunking out of the pilot training school and winding up doing the same thing, except sitting in back of the pilot instead of sitting alongside him, you know. That was the only big difference. And so I came back late. I got court-martialed. And then I got my rank back again when we went overseas. I mean, just to give you an idea how the military works. Well, there's one whole plane. Anyway. Well, that's more when I was drinking, I should say. Anyway, how am I doing on time, Ryan? Oh, I did 20 minutes already? Wow. Anyway, yeah, right. Now, I haven't gotten yet to my drinking. I got to go back now and tell you, with my mother, my father was a so-called, and he was, a social drinker. He liked to have a drink before dinner. When he came home, he was a hard-working guy. He was a manual laborer. And my father liked to take a drink. My mother never took a drink and never smoked. And she, learning now, and it's my mother, was a pure alcoholic. She, like we like to talk, she was a pure alcoholic personality. And my father was a happy-go-lucky social drinker. And that's my background with drinking. I did have one very, very bad problem in the service, which was directly related to my being up here tonight. And we had to fly. I had to fly. Does everybody know what getting over the hump is? Well, in the language, in everyday speaking today, when you get over the hump, you're getting over a problem that you had. But that saying comes from the hump is the Himalayan mountains, you know, China, Burma, and India. And our job was to carry supplies on these transports to the Flying Tigers, which was a Hollywood name. That was not their real name. The real name was the American Volunteer Group. But Hollywood gave them that name, and the name was very colorful, and it stuck. And the Japanese controlled everything on the ground, so the only way that we could get the supplies into China was over the Himalayan mountains and getting over the hump. And if we flew a certain amount of combat hours and missions, we get to go home. and hopefully in one piece. So that was my job. A year before, here I am on the streets of New York, right? I can't get into the Coast Guard, and here I'm flying my ass off over the hump. And my mother, I mean, I don't have to tell you what went on. And anyway, after a lot of close calls, I'm not going to go into that because I don't want you to give me a thing when I want to get to AA. That's what the gist of this leading is. I started to fly. We had the choice when we came there. We would fly with different pilots. It was like a trucking route, and we would load the planes with ammunition, donkeys. You know, we flew live donkeys in, mules into the troops, and gas, mostly gas, high-octane gas was mostly what we carried. And it was very humorous. Funny things happened because in those days, if a U.S. politician or somebody noteworthy got to take one trip over the hump, he could come back and be a circuit speaker and just talk about that. So we had a fellow, I'm trying to remember his name, actually, who was a very famous commentator in those days, and he came over to do that. He wanted to say that he flew over the hump. Now, he didn't go in my plane, he went in a friend of mine's plane, and the plane went down, but he survived in the jungle and took him 17 days to walk out. This is on his one trip that he wanted to take with his ego. And we were losing lots and lots of planes. And anyway, so our job basically was to ferry supplies and keep our troops in China supplied at all times when we couldn't reach them on the ground. The bottom line of all of this that I tell you was that the great thing that happened, and I learned this only after I got out and read about it, is that it wasn't so much the supplies we flew over, but that it kind of kept a million Japanese troops anchored in China when they would have been fighting all our guys in the Solomons and Guadalcanal and old Tarawa, all the battles that you've heard of, you know, the Marines in the South Pacific. So there was a big China presence over there. And anyway, so it got on and on, and I flew 20 missions, 30 missions, and I began to get a little nervous. Early on, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, you know. I didn't know how bad it was. And I'm still a teenager. And then I'm about halfway through, I'm really getting nervous, and I'm starting to count. But at that time, everything was seniority. I could go into the flight operations and pick out the pilots that I wanted to fly with, so I'm not flying with some guy who couldn't fly or was a newcomer. Like an A, I wanted to get an old-timer, you know. And we were able to start picking out our own pilots. I was about three-quarters of the way through to go home in one piece, and I was scared shitless, pardon my French. I really was. And the guy says, why don't you take a couple of drinks before we leave? And that was the beginning of my drinking career, is that I drank to combat fear. It made me feel better. It made me brave when I wasn't brave, and because I already knew how dangerous it was. If we lost per capita as many planes and men as they did over Europe, but in a much smaller manner. We lost 700 planes and 1,500 crewmen, and a great number of guys were able to bail out, which I had to do once. But it wasn't over the mountains, it was over the jungle, so I got out in 3 days. I have to tell you that story. I knew that if my parents received, this is part of my story, it's very, very important. I made friends with this guy in personnel, once who sent home the missing in action, killed in action, missing. I made friends with one guy. And I used to bring him stuff back from China. I went to China almost every day, every other day, that they couldn't get in India. And I said, but you got to do me a favor. If I go down, you got to give me a chance to walk out. If you went down over the mountains, and we never heard of anybody coming out, but if you went down over the jungles, sometimes it took them 2, 3, 4 weeks. We've had people walk out after 6 weeks. I took me, and so we went down, and we were only about 15 minutes out from the base, and it took me 3 days to get home, to get back to the base. And instead of going in to be debriefed, I went into personnel, this guy Mort, and I says, Mort, did you send that telegram home? He says, no. And I brought him stuff for the next 6 months. I was so happy because I could just imagine my mother receiving that I was missing in action. That's that big St. Bernard over here. Yeah. What? Okay, the drinking, right? My wife is prompting me, start talking about the drinking. Okay. She's right. Anyway, I literally got taught how to drink and how to do it, and it worked. Because I told you, I was flying as a crewman. I was a radio man. We actually were the navigators. We navigated with radio beams. We didn't have the technology that they had today. And we were losing planes like crazy. Not to the Japanese. They couldn't get as high as we flew. But to the weather. It's absolutely the worst weather in the world over the Himalayas. And I flew my last 10 missions drunk as a skunk. And the guys filled in for me. I was just fortunate. And I finished my missions, and I'm ready to go home. And then I get the most giant alcoholic resentment you ever saw in your life. You know, we have to get resentments here, you know. And this was one that stayed with me for the rest of my life. I finished flying. I finished all my missions, and I'm still a teenager. I finished at the beginning of April. 10 minutes left. Wow. It was a half hour now. And I finished at the end of April, and I'm waiting to go home, and we get word that the war was over. It could be, in a couple of weeks, will be the anniversary for Europe, not for the entire war. And they said, nobody's going home. Everybody from Europe is coming here, until they drop the atomic bomb about 4 months later. And then I finally got to go home. And it was great. I married a nice girl back home, but that drinking remained with me, and I became like a weekend drinker at home. I married this very lovely girl. We had three children. We were what they call the 52-20 club. I've got to tell this story. We were allowed to get $20 a week if we didn't have a job. And so I collected for 52 weeks. Every week, we go up there, and I said, I looked for a job. I couldn't get one. I just wanted to get the 20 bucks, which was a lot of money in those days, and get on home. So I collected that for about a year. And then I got married, and then I got into the business and went my merry way just drinking on weekends. And if I had an event to go to, I would drink something before so it would enable me to drink and not show you I was getting drunk. I was very ashamed of showing that I was drunk, but I wanted to have the feelings of being drunk. I wanted to have no fear and everything going, so I learned to drink milk before going somewhere to coat my stomach. And that kind of so great trick, right? To get, and then I wound up in here. And this went on for a number of years, and then came the credit cards in, and I had a credit card to drink, and I could charge it. And so I was this poor kid from New York, and here I am in New York, and I'm drinking martinis. I learned how to drink a Silver Bullet. You know what a Silver Bullet is? It was a House of Lords martini on the rocks with a twist of lemon. I still remember that. And that was really great. And I figured that would give me the courage to be able to meet customers, clients, and do well. And it worked. I started to do okay until in the 60s, my mother and my father and my wife died in rapid succession. My drinking, so-called, came out of the closet. I became a round-the-clock drinker, taking the wife for radiation treatment and chemo, which we all know about over here, was not the greatest. And the booze gave me, again, so-called courage until is sitting in the car, and I smell like hell in the morning, you know, just taking her for radiation treatments, and I started to get the, the treatment. And then, I'm starting to rush it up now, I went to my wife dies, and my mother and my father die, and here I am with three kids. I had a giant resentment against my wife, this real alcoholic. She went off and left me. And that was my big resentment. And I woke up in a doctor's office, and he said, "Do you want to stop drinking?" And I said, "Desperately. It doesn't do any more for me or anything." And he gave me antabuse. And I stayed on antabuse for 2.5 years, and that was the worst time of my drinking career. Was the 2.5 years I was dry as a bone. I wasn't drinking, but I was a pure alcoholic. No meetings, never went to an AA meeting, just on the antabuse. And that's the way I stayed sober, and it was brutal. And finally, somebody, a friend of mine, said, "Why don't you come into AA? You can get rid of the antabuse, and we go to these meetings." And that was the magic word for me. And I went on the antabuse for 2.5 years, kicked that, came into the program, and started to go to meetings. And if anybody is new, this is the way I did it. I got hooked on meetings, and it saved my life to this day. And this was my thing, is going to meetings. I was very, very fortunate. In Manhattan, in New York, you can walk to meetings. I'd leave work, and I could walk to a half a dozen meetings or jump in a cab. We didn't use a car at that particular time to go to meetings. And I just ate everything up at the meetings. It was just marvelous for me. And my three kids started to talk to me. My granddaughter is here tonight, and I'm very, very, very glad that she's here. And then I was sober 4 years after the 90 women in 90 days was, wore off a little bit, you know. And I was 12-stepping a new sponsee, and I go to a meeting, and I meet my beautiful wife to be there. And my whole AA even got even better. Actually, and that was that. I got sober in 1975, and I met Carol in 1979 at a meeting. Right? You better say right. And it was great. No more 90 women in 90 days, you know, any of that stuff. I concentrated on the meetings. And all I can tell you, it's a great way to get older. My big thing nowadays is if I wake up in the morning and I don't have a doctor's appointment, I'm in good shape that day. I really am. Really. I go to at least 3 meetings a week. My one thing is my beautiful wife has got me grounded for driving at night. My reflexes aren't like they used to be. I still drive in the daytime. And I had a great victory this week. I passed a written driver's test. No, it's not to laugh. I don't know if you know it, but when you pass 80, you have to take an eye test, and you have to take a written, it was 16 questions, and you're only allowed to get 3 wrong. Or you don't get your driver's license, you know. And of course, 5 years ago, I got 100%, and this time, at the age of almost 88, I got 90%, you know. I had to do a lot of studying, so that was my big victory this week, is that I retained my driver's license. But I'm how much time have I got, Ryan?
You got a few minutes.
Got a few minutes left? Don't forget, Ryan, tell me that. You know. I can't tell you how much I'm in love with this program, because my wife was quite sick about 3 years ago, and I thought I was going to lose her. And I always, I'm quite a bit older, not a little bit older, quite a bit older than she is, and I said, "You got to be around to take care of me, not me of you." But it looked like it was going to be that way, and you know where I got relief? At a meeting. Sometimes I'd go to an afternoon meeting, and I'd sit there, and I wouldn't hear a damn thing for an hour. But I felt relieved. Gilbert, who's here tonight, we go to the same meeting during the week. And I would sit there. And that, when she was in surgery that day, that's where I was. Instead of sitting in some waiting room, pacing up and down, and you know, I don't smoke anymore. You haven't for many years. And so I went to an AA meeting, and I got out of my own head for an hour. And it just, well, how can I say it to finish up? I always feel better after after the meeting is, you know, when I leave a meeting than when I come in. I mean, I came in here tonight. You're going to, boy, how are you going to talk for 45 minutes? Here I am fighting the clock, and Ryan is sitting there. And then he goes, he's timing me, Shay. And I feel like $1 million. I want to thank you. I mean, I think I had your attention. Gave you a little lesson in World War II. I go to a big men's meeting on Saturday. And I'm the last one standing from World War II. So if it wasn't for this infinality, if it wasn't for this marvelous, marvelous program, not only would I not be standing here, I would have been dead a long time ago. I'm able to help other veterans too. And I live a clean and happy life. And this has been the happiest almost 38 years of my life. Thank you all very, very much.